How am I going to beat former cop sentenced for selling drugs? I can't. Nothing I ever do will be that interesting.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From San Diego, California, you are my co-host, Keith Foster.
Mm-hmm, that's me. And from Los Angeles, California, is my host, Cassidy Robinson. I've realized there are two types of people in this world. The first type is people who have not seen Hamilton.
Okay.
And then the second type, which I am now gladly a part of, is a group of people that have seen Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
It's here. It's in San Diego, a touring show of it. Holy shit.
Lives up to the hype?
I didn't think there was any way it could, because it is like the most hyped show of all time.
Sure.
But it's really fucking good.
But, doesn't it feel like to you, or it feels like to me from an outsider, like I'm not really part of the whole, like, Broadway thing. But it feels like to me that every year has kind of a blockbuster, or every, like, 3 or 4 years, there's a blockbuster show that everyone's talking, like, Book of Mormon before this, and then Wicked at some point.
Yeah, and that's kind of true. You know, like, the hot Tony show of the year.
Yeah.
I mean, that does happen. But this one's different.
Fun Home from last year.
Yeah, and I saw Fun Home and Book of Mormon. Both are really good. I don't think they're both as good as Hamilton.
Wow.
It blew my socks off.
Wow.
But I also went in as pretty close to cold as you could. Like, I know some people who had seen it after they'd listen to the soundtrack, and it's kind of a hip opera. Like, there's music the whole time, so you can listen to the soundtrack and get a pretty good idea of the show.
I've heard selections from it before.
Sure, yeah, like you've probably heard like the "How does this bastard son of a whore," you know, like that whole business. You've probably heard the "Not thrown away my shot," like, you know, those are the things I'd heard.
Okay.
But in context of the show, it's like, oh, holy fuck. You know, I think it's especially, was especially powerful because we were watching it the night the government shut down.
As it likes to do every once in a while.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, this one was particularly dramatic. And I don't know. It's just, it's a very relevant, cool ass show, and I'm excited for the eventual movie adaptation, but I don't think it'll work the same.
Yeah, I don't know. I won't be as encumbered by that because I will probably have not seen the show. But it did in your showing of it, was Lin-Manuel Miranda there?
No, he dropped out of it a while ago. It's a touring company, but they were fucking great.
Yeah. I mean, you have to be.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it was tight. It was. I very rarely give standing ovations at shows. Like, you know, to me, it's like you're doing your job, kind of. Like if I go and I'm entertained, cool. I'm gonna clap. I'm gonna applaud. I'm gonna participate in theater. But you have to wow me for that standing. Oh.
Well, I mean, that's sort of the point of the standing ovation, but even if people like around you, like the people you went with and everything are standing, you'll stay seated.
Yeah. I will not be bullied into a standing ovation. I will not be peer pressured into it. You have to wow me. It's so common anymore. It's like tipping. People think that it's just the standard for musicals, right, that you have to give a standing O, and, you know, they don't... bullshit. No.
So even if the cast, as they're taking their bow, they see you up in the back and they're like, there, you!
Yeah.
I'll sitting, what is your deal?
I'll fucking mad dog him right in the eye and I'll say, you should have wanted it. You should have wanted it more.
All right. Well, I'm glad that Hamilton lived up to your hype.
I'm just saying, if you get a shot to see it, don't throw away your shot.
Oh my, I can't.
Yeah, I telegraphed that from a mile away.
I can't with you. Today we're going to be reviewing The Post. We're going to be catching up with that from 2017, a big Oscar contender. And at the end of the episode, we will also review the Netflix movie Bright. But let's go ahead and get into the movie news. We don't have too many stories that's popped up, but there has been a couple interesting ones here or there.
Movie news. Talking about that movie news.
Let's just do two stories. We'll start with this one. John Cena in talks to star as Duke Nukem in a Duke Nukem movie based on the old PC video game.
No.
No?
No. Here's the thing. A Duke Nukem movie would have only worked in like the late 90s, like 1998, when Howie Long should have played him. And it should have been like a Broken Arrow style, like action thriller.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want a 2000 whatever version of Duke Nukem. And I don't want more John Cena.
You're over John Cena?
I am over John Cena. I don't know when we decided he's acceptable as more than a giant meat slab. Sure, he's kind of fun on SNL or whatever, but you're not The Rock. It just... I've actually been meaning to bring this up since our movie resolutions. I was going to say, can we get less wrestlers being funny because... they're like, just because they're giant wrestlers.
Mm-hmm. Well, like, I think in the case of Duke Nukem, this would be John Cena playing the type, though. I'm not saying that he's a terrific actor.
It's not going to have that 90s, this is a, you know, $80 million movie, but for some reason it ages really poorly kind of charm to it.
Yeah.
Duke Nukem is not a character that withstands the test of time. No. And that's part of the appeal of that character, mm-hmm, is sort of how dated it is. He is like 90s action man.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't care.
I mean, as a character, he was kind of based on those like 80s action archetypes.
Yeah.
It was essentially like a Schwarzenegger game.
But it was like just tongue in cheek and postmodern enough, mm-hmm, to not be self-aware.
See, here's the thing. I'll say this about it. It's not going to be good because John Cena's not a very good actor, and the idea of video game movies is cursed as a concept for some reason. But I think if they took the direction of leaning into the camp, basically doing the
But here's the thing.
The 21 Jump Street version of it.
There's no such thing as leaning into the camp.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want it to be a 21 Jump Street. I don't want it to...
It doesn't have to be totally...
Here's the thing. It wouldn't totally be 21 committed. Jump Street. It would be Baywatch. It's not going to be 21 Jump Street because 21 Jump Street was good because it was a fresh and new take on it.
Right,
now, I'm getting over this now. Like, Chris Lord and
Chris Miller.
Yeah, like they have sort of a magic touch to me because they're smart, they're really clever.
For
them it works. Mm-hmm. But like now that it's become a thing, I'm kind of getting to where I'm like, ugh.
No, I know what you're saying. You can go too far doing that as well. And I wouldn't want it
even
to be
too far,
totally
like
cute and twee either. But I think that basically, if I were given this assignment, I would make it look and feel exact. I would do a nostalgia piece, like, for that, like, late 90s action movie.
Sure.
But here's the thing, Black Dynamite for the, like, 90s action set.
But, I mean, that, like, includes shitty CGI sharks. That, you know what I mean? Like I would be okay with it if it was Escape from L.A. But Escape from L.A. already exists, so I'm just going to watch that.
Okay.
No, not into it. I was just going to say, we should make t-shirts that just say, I'm not into it. Because I feel like that's become my catchphrase for movie news.
For movie news. Well, are you into this? Ryan Reynolds, just fucking too many places right now. Ryan Reynolds is making a Clue movie with the Deadpool writers.
No, I'm not into that. I want to know. The jury is still out on the Deadpool writers. We'll see how Deadpool 2 goes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm not as not into this as the John Cena Duke Nukem nonsense.
I'm less into this.
I don't know, man.
I don't have like the reverence that a lot of people have for the 80s Clue movie.
Well, that's a problem in and of itself. It's great.
It's great, and it certainly has a huge cult following. It's one of those movies like Monty Python, where people know all the dialogue.
I'm going to go on record.
It describes what kind of person you are that you would know all the dialogue to that movie. But
I'm going to go on record also as saying, Ryan Reynolds, you are no Tim Curry, sir.
Right. I think that's the bigger idea. The bigger problem here is I feel like, do we need like the bro Clue? Like,
yeah,
I think I don't know what, like, you know, what kind of person I would
guarantee
attach,
fucking but to you. Like, I will bet you money right now that there is a lead pipe as dick metaphor / joke.
Probably.
Like, I can already predict that.
Or it's just going.
Yeah,
to be
she like grabbed this my pipe in the library.
It's probably going to be a just an homage fest where they just keep winking at the camera to remind you that they've also seen the Clue movie from the 80s.
Yeah, and it's like, okay, I'll just go watch that Clue movie.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be one or the other. So I think this is even more unnecessary than a Duke Nukem movie. At least there's never been a Duke Nukem movie.
I guess. Here's the thing. I'll give you this, Ryan Reynolds. If I'll go see it. I'll do whatever. I'll do whatever you want. I'll tweet at it. I'll do whatever you want, Ryan Reynolds. If you just give Detective Pichu to Danny DeVito. If you pull back a little bit, if you show some self-restraint, you're like, oh, yeah, you know what? I do think Detective Pikachu should be Danny DeVito.
Ryan Reynolds agrees with that idea more than what? Him being in the part, other than he would like the job and the money.
Fuck that. He has enough money.
All right. So that's the movie news. That's all we're going to do this week. So let's go ahead and get into the post.
Are you ready to talk about Liberal Hollywood, the movie?
I mean, you're not wrong. Okay, so this is, I'll set it up. This is directed by Steven Spielberg. It's co-written by Liz Hannah and Josh Singer, starring Meryl Streep, Tom Hanks, and a whole lot of other people. A lot of comedians, actually.
Yeah, I want to say that something nobody's talking about the post for is the Mr. Show reunion.
Yeah, very bizarre.
Bob Odenkirk and David Cross share a scene, couple scenes together.
Scenes.
Yeah. Multiple scenes. And Bob Odenkirk had a way bigger part than I realized. Like, at first I was like, oh, cool, Bob Odenkirk's in this. And then I was like, oh, he's still in this.
Like, he is all up in this.
He's like a character.
Mm-hmm. We also have Bruce Greenwood, Bradley Whitford, Allison Brie,
which
Jesse
Bradley
Clemens.
Whitford, at this point, can we just say that Bradley Whitford is typecast as white privilege?
Yeah, well, slash smarmy asshole. But he's really good at it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's been good at it since Billy Madison. Mm. And I like to think that every movie he's done since then is in the Billy Madison-verse.
So, yeah, big, obviously big cast. Tracy Letts also, who was recently in the movie Lady Bird.
Yeah, I had no idea that was him.
He looks a little different without the beard, but that's actually the way he appears in the post is closer to how he appears normally.
Actually looks, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a harder time picking him out in Lady Bird because he was so under a beard. And we're burying the lead here talking about this cast. But basically, this is a movie about the Pentagon Papers that came out shortly into Richard Nixon's presidency in the late 60s, early 70s. The papers that were leaked that essentially revealed that we shouldn't have been there and that the military and the government pretty much knew that from the beginning, well early on into the Vietnam War, that we shouldn't have been there. And first a couple pages get leaked to the New York Times, and their main competition, the Washington Post, is trying to get in on the story and try and have a new angle on it when they get the mother load of information. And it becomes a sort of tense adult thriller about whether or not they can post these things legally without the government throwing them in jail slash losing all of their funding from their donors. So there's a lot of stuff in this movie, I think, that seems very relevant. There's a lot of stuff in here about freedom of the press.
There's moments where this movie drifts in and out of I'm trying to tell a story about this incident and hey, yeah, pay attention, get it.
There's a little bit of an activist bent, you could say.
Yeah, like there's almost moments where it like breaks the fourth wall, but it comes just shy of it.
Mm-hmm. And obviously, you know, movies take a little bit of time to make, so some of this stuff might be echoing more because of what's happened recently as far as, you know, the current administration's problems with the free press.
Fake news awards. How about the go fuck yourself awards?
Right. It personally feels maybe a little premeditated in some points of the movie. There's kind of two strands going here. There's the story about Tom Hanks, who's the main editor over at the Washington Post, Ben Bradlee, and him trying to get this scoop, and him in sort of friendly competition with the New York Times, and, you know, trying to speak power to truth, and blah blah blah. And then there's this other kind of B plot with Meryl Streep as the heir or owner of the Washington Post, Kay Graham, who sort of got this whole paper thrown in her lap after her husband died. And her trying to have some sort of impact on the newspaper industry itself and sort of establish herself as not just this poor widow who accidentally got this thing, but somebody who's actually interested in furthering its agenda.
Also, at the beginning of the movie, the newspaper goes public. It becomes a public company.
Mm-hmm.
And so a big part of the tension comes from will she publish this knowing that she has to answer to investors now?
Right.
It's not just a private enterprise, and the investors are scared to publish.
Exactly. Yeah. I personally think, and I'd be interested to hear your thoughts, I think that one of these stories is a whole lot more interesting than the other. And even though I would say that the Meryl Streep story is sort of the beating heart of this narrative, I actually think most of that stuff is fairly boring and bogs down the movie. And I don't think that you have to cut all of it out, but I think that this back and forth between the two narratives and the way that they tie together is a fairly cheesy and even for Spielberg, pretty sentimental. And it just slows down the drive of what would be this kind of intellectual thriller about them trying to get the story out in time. Like, every time they're building up momentum on that, we go back to Meryl Streep and she's at some dinner, you know, talking to these rich people and doing these monologues where she's weepy and Meryl Streepy about it. I don't know. What do you think?
Yes and no. I do agree with you that this movie's kind of bloated in some weird ways. Like, there's these, and they do come more from Meryl Streep, and I don't know if it's because she's so Meryl Streep at this point that's, you know, that it's like, oh, we're going to give her a showcase. But there's these, like, couple weird scenes where she's with Alison Brie, who plays her daughter. And literally, they talk about nothing. Like, nothing that really drives the plot forward. Doesn't really tell us a whole lot about the character that we don't already know. And they're like, these long, drawn-out, like, very actorly scenes.
Oh, there's a whole lot of actorly stuff in this movie generally.
Yeah, but these ones in particular stood out to me as a problem because they didn't really do much. And they were just kind of boring, and I was like, and they were so stagey that I was like, I don't need this. So yeah, I do think there is some of that. I mean, I think her story is good and necessary because it does add that tension. You know, she's sort of the swinging axe that is either going to stop Tom Hanks or defend him,
right?
And I think that tension is necessary, but yeah, I do think they could have cut some of that out that made it feel like there was some weird, like, posturing in this movie.
Yeah, there's weird stuff in the pacing. And I don't think that the story is bloated necessarily, because it's actually when it's...
Oh, I don't think the story is bloated. I think the movie has some moments of serious bloat.
Right, or just some lag. Because I feel like there's a lot of, like, the story itself is actually pretty simple. I would argue maybe too simple. Because when it's all said and done, you know, the story is about the Washington Post publishing this one or two articles. And when the movie was over, I kind of thought, like, I spent a long time waiting to get there. And then when it was over, I was like, oh, that's it. I was the structuring of this story is a little awkward as well.
A little. All of that being said, this might be lesser Steven Spielberg, but Steven Spielberg knows how to keep me engaged. Like, there's enough character and there's enough tension. And he does, there's some cool stuff at work. Like, there's some cool sequences. Like, there's a moment when they're like, you know, like, timing how long it's gonna get to get the paper out, and they're like showing the way the print press works, and it's a pretty effective sequence, and I dug Tom Hanks. I sometimes forget how much I like Tom Hanks and seeing him do things, and I think he worked really well with the material, and they make him sort of a shrewd kind of, like, they refer to him as a pirate a lot. And
I think part of the reason they split the story up the way they did, and part of the reason why Hanks is, I'd say he's a little overacting in this movie for my taste, but slash a little miscast, but I think what they were trying to get at is Hanks in this movie is sort of the archetypal, like, male businessman, you know, white collar, sort of loudmouth blowhard.
Yeah, and there's some problematic stuff with that, which I think comes up with Sarah Paulson.
Right. And then I think Meryl Streep's story, there's a little bit of a, not a little bit, there's a lot of bit of a feminist subtext going on there about her being able to find a voice in this company, and her, you know, there's all these scenes of like these businessmen around her who are talking over her like she's not in the room, and she's sort of empowered by this story that she wants to run. It's sort of the reason why she runs it, according to this screenplay. I actually think that both of their portrayals, as, you know, Streep is this mousy old lady, and Tom Hanks is this kind of curmudgeon-y, you know, loudmouth. Both of them are played a little too broadly. There's sort of, in general, this sort of unintentional camp going on here, because it almost...
Yeah, there's moments of it.
It's so historical costume drama-y sometimes that it almost feels... Like, it almost has the feeling like he was going for a Mad Men-ish type vibe by, like, how art-directed the whole thing is and how costumed it is. But it kind of, like... It kind of comes off a little bit like a stage play. Like, there's something kind of fakey about everything.
Yeah, yeah. And well, and it doesn't do any favors with these long, drawn-out, unnecessary character monologues. Right. And I think it would be different if those moments just had a little more to do with what's actually going on in the story. Yeah, this movie kind of toes the line between Oscar bait the movie and being an engaging sort of intellectual thriller. That being said, I still found myself enjoying it. I felt like there was enough meat there that, like, I wouldn't hold this up as sort of the prestige picture that the attention it's getting because of the message and because,
right,
you know, they're sneaking it in for the Oscars.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's necessary. It especially the year of movies we had, it doesn't hold up to a lot of that other stuff. It's so Hollywood that it's, you know, but I'm still glad I saw it. I still thought it was entertaining. I do think one of my favorite story arcs was Bob Odenkirk. I think he sort of held the movie together for me. And just like, you know, the ensemble cast, it is fun to sort of see all these character actors running around in a Spielberg given very character-y things to do.
Right, and with the John Williams score swelling in the background.
Yeah, so I still enjoyed it. I think it's a worthwhile movie experience. I just don't think it's as important as Hollywood wants it to be because of the message.
Right, I agree. Or as important as Hollywood wants it to be because of its pedigree. In a lot of ways, I feel like this is sort of a sister film to Lincoln. They're kind of similarly dialogue driven, and they're about you know, Lincoln was all about legislation, and this movie is all about sort of government information and leaking it. But they're both, the tensions of the movies are similar in that, you know, they're running around trying to share information essentially, and get a message out, and standing up for truth or what they see as truth, and then both are very relevant to American history. I think Lincoln does most of those things better and more subtly, and Lincoln is not a subtle movie.
I would agree with that.
I don't hate The Post, but I don't love it either. I think my issues with it, and, you know, being, you know, historically a Steven Spielberg fan, when he goes into this mode, this kind of like prestige film mode, and he's only done it like this since, I don't know, the last maybe 20 years or so. But I feel like he thinks he needs to make these movies this way. Like, they have to have this austerity about them. They have to sort of be underneath a, you know, protected glass, you know, and because of that.
Yeah, there's nothing really dangerous about it.
Even the war scene in the beginning, it starts out with a little scene of Vietnam, and I'm like, hello, you're the guy who made Saving Private Ryan. Why does this look like Max Fisher presents Vietnam?
Yeah. Yeah, it feels safe. It feels like we want people to care about the message, so we've got to make this movie as palatable as possible.
Yeah, and I don't know, I don't understand that choice. And also, like, I think honestly, both the Meryl Streep character and the Tom Hanks character would have been more interesting with different actors. If you'd put Bob Odenkirk in that Tom Hanks role, it would have been even more, like, Tom Hanks is entertaining to watch chew up the scenery, but I think somebody who, you know, blends into the scenes more than commanding them,
mm-hmm,
would have been more interesting. And I think somebody who, unfortunately, you know, I don't know, I kind of feel like both of those actors are sort of used as props in this movie.
I think there's times when they are, for sure. I think that, I mean, I still think they both do their jobs and they both deliver.
They're not bad performances, but they are exceedingly safe for even both of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I just look at those both of those roles and I kind of see, like, man, we really could have had something else there.
Well, I mean, just look at the poster, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's Streep and Hanks at the very top.
That's what they're selling it. Yeah.
Yeah, the post is in this tiny font at the bottom. Exactly. Like, there's, because they care, again, they want to sell this message so much, and I get that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, nobody's going to go see a movie called The Post. It's just about, like, you know, people be like, it's about a newspaper thing. Like, I get.
I don't know why they didn't call it The Pentagon Papers. That was the going title for X amount of years when I was working at The Wrap and we were doing stories about the development of this movie. They were still calling it The Pentagon Papers, which I think, even if that was just sort of a placeholder for a going title, is a better title than The Post.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with the name The Post. I get that that's a hard sell. Like, it's not,
mm-hmm,
it's not sexy.
But they made it harder for themselves. The Pentagon Papers sells, that sells itself better than The Post. Well,
yeah.
I think the reason they did that, is because The Washington Post has more recently become more, famous in the zeitgeist for its opposition to our current administration.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they wanted to kind of, again, sort of underline that they couldn't call it The Washington Post because it might have been too on the nose, especially for middle America.
Well, yeah, and I mean, it is also about, there's this, like, message of solidarity between the newspapers as well, so.
Yeah, that's a big thing in it.
Yeah. I don't know. Overall, I thought it was fine. Like, I think, mm-hmm, it's worth seeing, and there was enough good stuff that, the other stuff was like, okay.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I just don't think this deserves all the critical acclaim that it's been getting. That to me is the kind of gross.
I'll say this, and I'm kind of sort of criticizing the critics at this point, because critics love movies about journalists.
Yeah.
And they love the inside baseball of it, and especially journalists as heroes. Can't get enough of it.
No, I know. I mean,
it's
the same reason I'm annoyed with Dunkirk.
Nah, I think both those two movies. I'm probably about as lukewarm on. I'd say more lukewarm on The Post, because I think Dunkirk is more interesting structurally. This, and is at least a little experimental and trying to do something new. To me this is like, almost like somebody was trying to make Oscar bait, like almost to the point of self-parody. I like a lot of the side performances in this movie. I like some of the thriller aspects of it towards the middle and end when they start showing instead of telling so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of telling in this movie. That was a big problem I had with it. Yeah. It was so on the nose.
A little, very on the nose. Again, this is Steven Spielberg, so sentimentality is something he's always been known for. And sometimes it can go overboard, and I think it does in this movie, but that's not even necessarily the problem with it. I don't mind that he wants to... I don't know. It's the austerity of it. It's the, this is an important film about important subjects.
Exactly.
And I don't think, I think you could do this exact movie. Actually, you could probably hand this screenplay to like somebody like a, I'm just throwing a name out there, but somebody like a Danny Boyle, who's a little bit more of a tactile director.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, do some of this stuff on Steadicam, make it a little bit, a little grittier, just a little realer, and that it wouldn't feel so much like we're watching some costume drama.
Yeah, I agree.
So I'm kind of lukewarm on it, but I think that it's worth seeing. I would say wait.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yes and no. I think it's worth seeing. It's worth seeing now because it is pretty relevant, and that.
I think something being relevant isn't enough of a reason. I think there's more relevant and more entertaining movies.
Here's the thing. I think it is worth seeing because of that. That's what's frustrating is I think the story is really important right now, and you know that journalism should be a real respected thing, and not I do think that's important, and I do think that's worth seeing right now, and that's what's frustrating is the movie is such a movie that it almost gets in the way of that.
Fair enough. Okay, let's get into.
Did you want me to talk about Jumanji? I saw Jumanji. I'll give you a real quick.
Okay.
So I saw the sequel to Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle. This time it's not a board game, it's a video game. And instead of the jungle coming to suburbia, the suburban characters are transported to the jungle. I'm going to say it wasn't as bad as I thought. Wasn't as dumb and awful as the trailers made it look. I mean, it's not great. It is way more of a direct sequel to the first Jumanji than you'd realize.
Yeah, I thought it was a remake.
No, it's a direct sequel.
Or like just a reboot or reconceptualizing.
No, it's a straight up sequel.
Oh.
But it's got some good moments. I feel like, you know, Dwayne Johnson is reminding us why he's a star. Jack Black steals the show. He's pretty great.
Uh-huh.
And has a lot of fun moments. It's not terrible. Like I said, it looked pretty dumb. There's some dumb jokes.
Right.
For sure. And I had a rant the other day about like the difference between like jokes and earned character laughs.
Mm-hmm.
And this movie does have some straight up jokes in it.
Mm-hmm.
That are like, okay.
They're kind of telegraphed.
Oh, yeah. Like there's this dumb joke where they showed it in the trailer, so it's not a spoiler.
The cake one?
Yeah, the cake one. It doesn't even make sense. Why would a video game character ever have the weakness of cake?
I don't know. Like, you and Ashley play those like insanely difficult to understand and play board games that have about as dumb of rules.
Okay. Not that dumb. There's no situation ever where someone's just going to eat a cake and explode for literally no logical reason. And that's, you know, like some of the other characters, you know, like one of the characters' weakness is venom. Mm. Sure, that makes sense. They're in a jungle. They're playing a jungle game. It kind of doesn't make sense because everybody's weakness is venom because that's the nature of venom. It poisons you. But sure. But, you know, literally cake makes you explode. And I thought the movie was going to have a lot more of that.
Right.
But it has a lot less than that than I realize. It doesn't really work as a video game metaphor because they don't seem to understand how video games work.
Mm-hmm.
But as a movie, it's decent. It's entertaining enough. Like I didn't think it was totally dumb.
Okay.
There's an audience for this movie. It's not great. I still think, you know, the first one is better, but it's better than I thought.
Okay. Yeah, I kind of like, judging from the trailer, I was like, that could possibly be an okay Sunday matinee type of situation.
Yeah, and that's kind of how we saw it. And it was like, It was, you know, it's fun, it's silly, it's, it does have some pretty dumb moments, but then it has some pretty good laughs as well. So it's worth seeing with the family.
Okay, that's what my other question was going to be. What kind of age range are they aiming for?
Like I said, I think it's pretty similar to the first one as far as like content goes. Mm-hmm. You know, there's, you know, it's pretty safe PG-13.
A light PG-13.
Yeah, I mean, I, it's the same as a lot of remakes and sequels. It doesn't capture the charm of the original, but it's fine.
To be totally honest, it's been a long time since I've seen the original. I'm not so certain that was ever that good of a movie. I think that might just be a we were young when it came out kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the lens I was viewing this, was like, would I have enjoyed this, you know, when I was younger, seeing it with my family? And sure. I think I for sure would have. It's, there's more to it than just the cake joke.
Okay. All right. Well, let's go ahead and get into Bright, then. This is the new Netflix original film, and there's been a lot of, news about this recently about how Netflix is trying to encourage people to watch it, despite the fact that it got terrible reviews. There's this whole thing about this disparity between the user ratings and Rotten Tomatoes and blah, blah, blah. And I feel like that's a narrative that's being pushed ever so much in the media right now.
Yeah, I feel like
I'm about to write an op-ed about the entire thing, but
well, I mean, it is annoying how whenever I see both sides. I think it's frustrating that audiences are so reliant on Rotten Tomatoes. I do it. Yeah. Like, I'm damn well going to see Paddington 2, 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, highest rated movie of all time.
And you've seen the first one. That helps.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, I think there's a weird disparity right now of holding Rotten Tomatoes to too high of a standard and to the movie studios blaming it as a scapegoat for shitty movies.
Right. This is directed by David Ayer, who just recently did Suicide Squad, also did the movie Fury, and what was the cop one? End of Watch. And this is written by Max Landis, and Will Smith and Joel Edgerton star. This is sort of a fantasy magic realist reimagining of LA, I guess present days or maybe future, LA in which, sort of the Tolkien
like alternate contemporary alternate reality.
Yeah. Alternate reality LA in which the Tolkien, mythological beings, elves, orcs, etc., fairies, live in a normal LA with everybody else. Will Smith plays a cop named Daryl Ward. His partner is an orc named Nick Jacoby, played by Joel Edgerton. And there's this whole situation where the orcs in the city are sort of like a minority, and they're, you know, there's orc gangs and they're not to be trusted. And Jacoby is sort of an outlier because he is a police officer and seems to want to do the right thing, though a lot of the people in the police force don't trust him and they think that he's going to pledge allegiance with his clan rather than with the police. This all kind of comes to a head when they discover a runaway elf girl who has a magic wand. Magic wands are like the baddest ass weapon that's ever existed. Whoever's pure enough to wield one can pretty much alter reality however they see fit. Everyone's after the magic wand. It is the MacGuffin of the movie. So Joel Edgerton and Will Smith are running around trying to protect this girl and the wand and keep it from getting in the hands of elf gangs and orc gangs and the corrupt police. And yeah, it's super violent.
I think that sums it up pretty well. Yeah, I'm curious how what you thought of it.
I had a hard time with it when I first started watching it. Speaking of telling and not showing, Max Landis, my God. This movie's so conceptually driven. And he bashes you in the face with his labored metaphors of race relations and, police brutality and violence and these things that we've heard a lot about recently. Well, and historically, to be honest. And I think that the first half hour of this movie, or 40 minutes of this movie, is so steeped in world building that it's really difficult to get past how blunt and over the top these metaphors are, and ungraceful. And I honestly stopped the movie about 3 times and tried to come back to it at different times because it was like every scene was like pulling a tooth. It was so difficult to watch. But then once I got to the point in the movie in which they find the girl and they find the MacGuffin, the magic wand, and they're running around the city, and it turns into the David Ayer thing, the thing that David Ayer likes to do, these movies about people trying to, Guns of the Navarone style, make their way through a difficult situation, and they gotta, just mow people down and get through these ghettos and these strip clubs and stuff, and it's just set piece after set piece. Once the movie kind of stops with all the talkie-talkie, I enjoyed it a lot more from that point on. I'm not going to say it's a good movie. I think too much of this is kind of stupid to be good, but it's moderately entertaining if you turn your brain off.
See, I dug it. I was into it. I do agree with you as far as the first act goes about how exposition filled it is, mm-hmm. and there were so many moments of me being like, wait, what? Okay, they can't drive. Like, I get that at the start. There's a lot of, uh-huh. Okay, here's the rules of this movie. Yeah. Like, they might as well have just, like, had, done the 90s prologue bit, mm-hmm. of just have, like, a black screen with, you know what I mean, where the like, high fantasy movies, yeah. in the 80s and 90s would be like, in a world where orcs were raised as, you know what I mean?
Right, right.
Like, just do that and get it out of the way, and then we can enjoy, like you said, the meat of the movie, mm-hmm. which is this, sort of buddy cop story. It's Bad Boys with orcs and elves.
Yeah, and there's a lot of callbacks, I think. Either intentional or not, I'm not sure. But there's a lot of callback to sort of Will Smith's whole career in this movie. There's a lot of, like, sure. Men in Black stuff going on. And there's also...
And maybe that's why it worked for me. Okay. One of the things I liked about Suicide Squad was I was like, oh, man, I miss Will Smith as a charming, sort of roguish, ne'er-do-well hero. Mm-hmm. And this movie gives me that, but without... the Suicide Squad baggage. I it is real high concept, mm-hmm. and I get that that's not going to work for a lot of people. And I also, like, it is hard to get this world building out in an elegant way. And I do think it could have done that better. I also think the name of the movie is dumb as shit. Bright just is an ugly, hard word to say that doesn't evoke any emotion or anything. And I'm getting real sick of dumb movie titles. Uh-huh. That's a different rant. Like, this movie should have been called Orc Cop. and I think, maybe, I don't know. I think it maybe takes itself. Well, I don't know. I think the marketing takes itself a little too seriously, but I think there's some fun shit, like especially Joel Edgerton. I think him and Will Smith have some great chemistry. I like both of their characters, and it's enough for me to want to see them come out on the other end of this adventure.
Yeah, I think them being sort of the heart of the story, and them their friendship. Developing, this distrust between the two, sort of, turning into a real partnership.
Do you know what this movie is to me? It's Reign of Fire.
Oh, okay, that's interesting.
I have a place in my heart for that movie. It's not great, but it's sort of like a B science fiction fantasy melding. Yeah, it to me, it was like I enjoyed it on all the same levels that I enjoy Reign of Fire. I do think the third act has sort of the modern third act action problem.
It just overends,
over
climax.
Yeah, and it's just like, okay, I was way more into them running from orc gangs than, you know, it just gets so action movie indie. I mean, at least a sky laser doesn't come out, but yeah, I don't know. I thought it was, I think it's fun. I think it has a better budget and production value than a movie like this probably should have gotten.
Oh.
But that makes it more enjoyable. Like, I don't know. I like it when...
I think the action scenes are executed really well, and I like the fight choreography, especially, like, between these speedy sort of martial arty elves and that stuff. Yeah. That's all really cool. And I think Joel Edgerton gives actually a really good performance, especially since he's buried under so much makeup. Like, it would be hard to, like, to emote through that, but he does, and he becomes a very sympathetic character.
Also, I think the production design,
the look of the movie,
the orc gangs and stuff are way more thought out than they needed to be, and all of that I think helps sell a movie that could have been a lot worse.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say the best of David Ayer's work has sort of a throwback crime film quality to it, you know, or action movie quality to it, where it does feel like something that would have been more mainstream in like around like 1998, 1999.
Yeah.
And, you know, it reminds me of movies like Strange Days or something like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
But
that's what I mean. Like,
I can't forgive the screenplay, which is so on the nose and so heavy-handed a lot of the times. And it wouldn't have been too hard to give that thing another pass and to delete half of this bad dialogue. Or just honestly, just let the actors improv it, because it would have been better than the dialogue that's written most of the time.
Yeah, I mean, you know what? No, I enjoyed this movie. I thought it was a lot of fun. I miss movies like we're describing. I don't think every one of them has to be. I don't know. I don't think action movie. I'm sort of torn because I acknowledge the problems you're talking about. It's not like they don't exist. It takes me back to a time when movies were sort of allowed to make mistakes like that. Mm-hmm. And I think it's, I don't know, I had enough fun with it to where it didn't bother me. It was just like, oh, okay, this is a silly, high concept, dumb action flick.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it worked on all those levels. And as far as, like, maybe that's just sort of with the state of where action movies are at right now, you know, aside from like the Marvel fare, is that I want more movies sort of this caliber, like, you know, give me less Transformers, give me more of this. I enjoyed it.
Honestly, I would say that feeling comes not in spite of, but almost because of the Marvel fare. I think that kind of action filmmaking, that huge tentpole CGI universe, you know, megaverse movie franchising that's been done for the last 6 or so years has really starved us for these kind of grittier street level, harder R action films that we have. And we get maybe one or two a year, whereas before this used to sort of be the genre.
Like this would have been a summer tentpole movie in
like 98. Yeah.
But that's what I mean. Like, and maybe maybe it is a nostalgia thing, because that's sort of when I was, you know, like, that's when I was, like, the prime audience for those type of movies.
And that's when Max Landis would have been the prime audience for those movies.
Sure. So, I don't know. To me, it was, I liked it. I had a fun time. I don't know if it was nostalgia or what, but I think it's entertaining. I was like, oh, okay, cool. Orc cops, elves are, you know, this elitist thing. Mm-hmm. I do think, yeah, they could have gotten to it a little quicker. But I was along for the ride. I was into it.
Okay. Yeah. I would suggest it for a certain kind of hard nerd. Like, yeah. I think if you're, like, super into high fantasy, you're super into, I don't know, the type of movies we're talking about. If you liked Reign of Fire, yeah.
I cannot think of a better analogy for this movie.
Mm-hmm. Or if you were the type of person in eighth grade who were, you know, drew on your notepad, like, all of your own kind of characters for a fantasy.
You mean type. Like us?
Yeah, essentially.
I think that's what makes me sad, is there's a point in time when you would have loved this.
No, I acknowledge that completely. If I was in eighth grade, this would have been my jam through and through, you know.
Yeah, so let that eighth grade.
I will say that given how hard it was to get through that first 35 minutes or so, I was surprised at how much I came around to it by the end. I was like, okay, like, it's dumb, but I get it. I get why this is fun. Whereas by that, if you would have told me before that I would be at that point, I would have told you, fuck you, this movie sucks. But but I was able to get into it again once they stopped talking and started shooting and jumping over things.
Sure. And I mean, that's what this movie should be. Mm-hmm. It should be Will Smith pointing his gun, popping off some one-liners.
Yeah.
And that's what I got, mostly.
Mostly. Okay, so next week we're going to do a request for a Netflix homework from a viewer or listener, I should say. Patrick, a long time ago, requested us.
Like in October.
In October, requested us to talk about the film, the documentary
Icarus.
Yeah, which is...
I didn't forget Patrick. Cassidy was like, no, Patrick can fuck off. Like, I don't want to do that. And I was like, no, we have a responsibility. We have a responsibility to print the news. And Meryl Streep was like, well, I don't know. And Tom Hanks was like, well, I know. And I was like, yeah, I'm with Tom Hanks. And Bradley Whitford was like, I'm a white dude.
That's how it went down, exactly like that. And I should say that Rod of the Listening Party also requested a movie, but we forgot what it was, and we can't find it on Twitter.
We can't find it.
At us.
Send it to us. We'll do it. We will do it.
We will do it.
It might take us 6 months, but we'll do it.
Yeah, we totally forgot what that movie that was. So get in my inbox, let me know what movie that was, and we'll slate it for next time. So that's the show. Twitters?
At Keith Foster Kid. Instagram, at Keith Foster Kid. Yeah, find me on Facebook, I think, at Keith Foster Kid. Google me. Google me so those hits go up. Google Keith Foster Comedian. Don't Google Keith Foster, because the chief of Fresno Police comes up, who was arrested for drug smuggling or something, which fucking sucks, man. Like, there's no way I'm gonna ever out Google that. That's some interesting shit.
The only other famous Cassidy Robinson that I know is a female Christian folk singer. So I have that going for my Google.
Have game. You ever Googled yourself?
Oh yeah, that's what comes up. Is this and. For a while, I was following her on Twitter, and then whenever she would post something about, like, going to a baby shower or something like that, I would retweet it, but then she blocked me.
That's funny. Yeah, well, I mean, that's okay, though. Like, she's a folks... Like, I feel like you could do something to be more exciting than Christian Folksinger.
I don't know.
How am I going to beat former cop sentenced for selling drugs?
I can't.
Nothing I ever do will be that interesting. Next Tuesday, January 30th, I'm doing the All-Star Comedy Jam in Bonita. Mm-hmm. And then this was just confirmed. On February 9th, I'm going to be doing Birdhouse Comedy Proudly Presents at the Comedy Palace. Uh-huh. Both of those are stand-ups. And then February 10th, the next night, my improv show, Slack to the Future, has a show at Finest City Improv. I think it's at like fucking 11 o'clock. So, if you're in it to win it, come out to that. But, yeah, come check out some of these shows.
Okay. You can follow me at BC Cassidy on Twitter. You can follow the show at Jabber Podcast. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/JabberPodcast. You can find the show's archives and the RSS feed at jabberandthedrone.podbean.com. Email us with any questions or requests or any comments on what we talked about today or on other episodes at jabberandthedrone@gmail.com. You can read the movie reviews that I do for the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. You can also read the content I provided to the Seattle-based entertainment site MacGuffin at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy.
What's that again?
Be sure to listen to our friends out there who are doing their own podcasts. We also have Rod and Denise over at The Listening Party. They are three or four episodes into the new format now, and I'm starting to get adjusted to it. It is an adjustment, but I am getting adjusted, and I kind of like what they're doing over there. Have you listened to it yet?
I haven't. I'm a little behind on that one, to be honest. Mm-hmm. Thanks for outing me.
Yeah, now they're delving into one song per episode. So somebody presents a song, and they talk about how it influenced their life over the X amount of times they've listened to it, or what the meaning of the lyrics is, and all of that stuff. So it's kind of interesting.
So it's a little deeper dive?
Deeper dive, more narrow.
All right.
Denise's solo podcast, The Mascot Diaries, is coming to a close, I think, after 51 or 2 episodes. She hinted at a famous mascot guest coming up here soon. So I'm not sure who that is, but you can only guess.
Fun.
And who else do we listen to?
Let's plug our friend of the show, Adam Connie. Uh-huh. You can check him out at iamadamconnie.com. Check out his podcast, The Adamant Podcast. Uh-huh. Blizzlet. I'll give them a shout out. They're launching a Patreon.
Oh wow!
They've actually. It sounds like they've got a little bit of a
following
that's starting to grow, which is nice. So you can check them out at patreon.com/blizzlet. And yeah, hopefully they do well. So congrats to them on getting that started, and hope it goes well for them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And also listen to Patrick and his dad at Make Dad Read Comics, and Patrick and his co-host Dennis at Almost Educational. I don't know if your episode, the one you did with him, is still the last one they've done, but you're on there like one or two episodes ago.
Mm-hmm.
And check out Bill and Brian over at the Great Albums podcast. They just did an episode about the Velvet Underground and Nico album, which I texted them or tweeted to them. It's maybe one of the albums I've probably listened to the most in my lifetime. Like somewhere in there, if there's a top 10. I haven't actually counted, but I would imagine that one would be high up there. And I think that... Oh, and Mike Valick over at Let's Start a Cult.
Yeah.
So...
Cool.
That's a
getting a lot of shout outs.
Yeah, this is a shout out city.
Yeah, we should start a network.
All right.
A little podcast network. Also, We're done, right? I'm shutting this shit down. I'm making this new tagline work. It's gonna get us through 2018. All right, you ready? Cookies are for closers.
All right. Bye.